Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Israel Studies. I'm Yaakov Yadgar, the host of the channel. Today we're talking to Michael Brenner about his new book, In Search of Israel, The History of an Idea. The book offers a history of the Zionist idea and the debate over its embodiment in 70 years of Israeli statehood. Professor Brenner, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let me ask or open with the rude question that is often asked with the publications of such history books. Do we really need another history of the Zionist idea in Israel? Or, to put it positively, what new perspectives or perspective do you offer to study these interesting matters?
You know, I thought the same before I started this project, and then I looked and realized we actually do not have a history of how the Jewish state was conceived, how it should look like, how it changed over time. We have a lot of histories of Israel, we have histories of Zionism, we have a lot of histories of the conflict, of the wars. That's not what the book is about. So in a way, I thought we need a book that shows, in a way, systematically over 100 years or more, how this idea of the Jewish state developed and what were the competing concepts.
Wonderful. So the history of Zionism can always be a history of diplomacy or realpolitik or a history of an idea. And your book does a very interesting job in combining the two in a way, going from the idea to how it is personified, I guess, or embodied in a state that is identified as a Jewish state. So I guess the question would be immediately arising, what do you see as the main keys to understanding the history of the state?
So I'm sure there are different possibilities to approach. What I found as kind of a connecting link or red, like a thread through the whole history of conceiving this state of the Jews or the Jewish state was the ongoing conflict between, on the idea of to have a state like any other state, and finally Jews would become a nation like any other nation. And on the other hand, there is still, and in many, among many of these thinkers and politicians at the same time, the idea of being different and being, in fact, an exemplary state, a model state,
a light unto the nations. A Jewish European yearning for normalcy, to be like anybody else. But at the same time, a Jewish strong sense of particularism, right? Of something that characterizes this body politics that is different than others. Can you maybe say a few words about how each of these poles would define Israel?
Sure. Let me maybe start with the story with which I start the book. It is told by Isaiah Berlin, the important philosopher from Oxford, who was with Chaim Weizmann, who was not yet the president of the state of Israel because it didn't exist yet. He tells about the 1930s and he says, we're at this tea party in Oxford and an older Christian lady approached Mr. Weizmann and said, Mr. Weizmann, how is it possible that you, the Jewish people, want to have a state which is not different than any other state. You, the people who brought about all these Nobel Prize winners and all of these, you know, important people, and you want to be like Albania? And then Isaiah Berlin's, Chaim Weizmann's head lit up like a light bulb, and he said, yes, Albania. So there is this for normal, as you said, for normalcy, for normality, for a normal state. And even in the Declaration of Independence, it speaks about a state like a nation like any other nation. So this is an idea which I think we see still today, when, of course, Israeli politicians also say, you know, we want to be measured like any other state. We do have the other concept, and that is very present from the very beginning. If you look at Theodor Herzl's writings, if you look at writings in the interwar period, especially Ben-Gurion's speeches and writings in the early years and decades of the state, where we always have the, well, it's not enough to be like any other state. We don't need another state with another flag, set of embassies around the world. The Jewish state has a special obligation to fulfill. Jews cannot just have a state like any other state. Ben-Gurion often used this concept of, and then he also used the comparison with the prophetic language of light unto the nations. And so does Netanyahu in recent speeches, and so do other members of the cabinet. And there is a tension, which I think is also explicit in Israeli policies. One example, when Ben-Gurion in the 1950s recognized his ties with what was called the Third World, with African and Asian states. Of course, it was important for strategic reasons, for economic reasons, but there was something else behind it. And he emphasized this over and over again. We have a special mission to help other emerging states. We have the means and we have the historical missions to help other states to develop.
So this tension touches directly upon, I guess, the central issue both in your book and in contemporary Israeli politics, which is the debate about or over the very meaning of Israel being a Jewish state. You hinted to it at the beginning of your answers, I guess, when you said it's either a Jewish state or a state of Jews, which are two different concepts in a sense. So let me ask you it's a question that is easy to ask, but obviously hard to answer, but maybe we can start a discussion. What does it mean for Israel to be a Jewish state?
It depends whom you ask. And that was true today. And as I try to show, that was true 50 years ago and was true before the state existed years ago. Former head of the Israeli Supreme Court, Barak, said, basically, a Jewish state means that we have certain Jewish symbols, like in our national anthem. We have the Saturday, Shabbat, as the holiday, not Sunday. We have Jewish holidays. We have certain values which we take. And there it already gets a little bit tricky, because many of the same values which are Jewish values, and he says so, are the values of modern human rights and so on. But they emerge from our biblical and later rabbinical traditions. But of course, you could also argue that a Jewish state could be something very different than this concept, which is clearly this concept, which is a Jewish and democratic state in the modern Western tradition with certain symbols. And by the way, the right of all Jews to return or to immigrate to Israel. But another concept was developed, for example, by Orthodox Jews. And that was the case before the state was founded. The first chief rabbi of Palestine, Rav Kook, had a very different concept. And the first chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Herzog, had a very different concept, where they clearly thought that halakha, Jewish religious laws, should play a much larger role than they actually do. And that religion should play a very clearly stated role. Now, Israel does not have a constitution, and therefore it is still an open conflict. What exactly constitutes the values of these states? Now, you have certain basic laws which try to define some of these issues, but overall, I would say it is still very confusing today for many people in Israel and outside of Israel what a Jewish state is.
So this issue of diverging or differing and sometimes conflicting answers to the question of what is a Jewish state is the center of the now famous Four Tribes speech by Reuven Rivlin, the Israeli president, in which he basically presents a mirror to his audience, saying we're no longer, if we ever were, a one whole national unit, but rather an amalgamation of tribes with different horizons. And you conclude your book with this speech and with this outlook of diverging views of Israel. And I think maybe we can discuss for a moment two of these horizons, which are usually taken to be the polar opposites of each other. You already discussed a bit the ultra-Orthodox horizon. Do you see any action towards an establishment of a theocracy, of making Israel into a theocracy in an ultra-Orthodox halachic manner?
I do not. What I see is increasing influence of the Orthodox sectors because the demography is changing and they represent a larger number. What I don't see is an attempt to rebuild Israel as a theocracy. One of the reasons is that in that case, the ultra-Orthodox would have, in fact, to take responsibility and to govern. And I don't think that this is their intention. It is a theological problem, of course. Could there be a Jewish state before the Mashiach, before the Messiah will appear? Concepts have been transformed, especially within what we call the national religious faction. If you look 100 years ago, it is very interesting to see that Mizrahi, the original Mizrahi, which was the religious national religious Zionist faction, was Zionist not because of messianic aspirations, but despite messianic aspirations. They tried to keep messianism out of the concept of a Jewish state, and they argued that, well, in fact, the Jewish state should, in fact, only be established after the coming of the Messiah, but we have an emergency situation. Jews are being persecuted. Back then, it was in the Russian Empire before the First World War, there are pogroms. We need a place for them. And that is interesting. It's interesting because it was the religious Zionist Mizrahi, many of them were in favor of the Uganda concept. They said, well, that may solve our problem. We have a Jewish state, but it's not in Israel, but we save the Jews and we don't come into conflict with our, you know, with our theological issues. This changed dramatically, especially after the Six-Day War in 67, where the land of Israel became the central element, especially for the Zionist religious faction.
At the other poles, we usually identify secular Israeli Jews. And reading your book, I was reminded, I guess, very clearly in the forefront of this discussion is the rhetorical question thrown at Herzl by Ahad Ha'am with the publication of Altneuland, what is exactly Jewish about your state? So reading about secular Israeli Jews and the horizon that at least in Rivlin's speech is being drawn, the question that I would want to ask you is, what is the meaning of Israel's Jewish identity in this context, the context of Israeli secularism?
Yeah, sure. If we go back to Herzl as the founding father, who every political faction considers their ancestor in a way, it seems that many of them either didn't read Herzl or really misread him. And in fact, interesting source is a book Shimon Peres wrote in the late 1990s, where he, my travels with Herzl through Israel. So he takes an imaginary Herzl and travels through Israel and writes a new Altneuland. And Peres says, well, I actually never read Altneuland. And if Peres didn't read it, I assume most politicians and probably most Israelis, of course, did not read it, although it's a fun book to read, I must say. But if you look at Herzl, you're right. There is really very, very little Jewish content in this, in his imaginary. He didn't call it Israel. He didn't. He called it, in fact, he often used the term seven-hour land because he thought it would be a seven-hour workday. And this is not a particularly Jewish concept, as many other things. He thought it would, this, you know, the state of the Jews, as he called it, would include the best of European, what European civilization has to offer. French operas, English boarding schools, he said, and of course, Viennese coffee houses. Well, if you go to Tel Aviv today, much of that fact is there. The only difference is Herzl, that he thought there would no Hebrew. Hebrew would not be spoken. He himself didn't know Hebrew. He thought it would be German and French and all the European, as he thought, cultured languages. So there was a concept of a state of the Jews, which would be an idealized Europe transformed and taken into the Middle East. That is one concept. The other concept growing out of Hada'am and cultural Zionism is also that of a secular Israel, but one which has decidedly Jewish values, even if they're secularized, based mainly on the Hebrew language and Hebrew culture. And I would say that secular Israel today, and then of course we look at Tel Aviv, is a mixture of both. We have the Hebrew culture and Hebrew language revived, and the fact that today around the world we have about maybe around even almost 10 million speakers of people who speak Hebrew or able to speak Hebrew in their everyday life is something Herzl could not have envisioned and didn't even wish for. At the same time, we have a society which is also in a way brought many of the Western values, European or American, is what we call today the startup nation, is leading place in high-tech industry. Herzl would have loved that because he loved modern technology.
Do you think it's fair to judge Israel against the Herzlian utopia? Is it a productive exercise?
I think we have to be very careful. Herzl lived 120 years ago, and people often ask, what would Herzl think today? And of course, we don't know who Herzl would be today. After the Holocaust, which even he, as a pessimist when it came to the Jewish future in Europe, even a pessimist like him, of course, never could have or did envision the ultimate catastrophe, the Shoah, the Holocaust, and that would be, in a way, part of the creation story of this Jewish state. So it is hard for us, and I say this as a historian, who we know today what happened in the 115 years after his death, and we're not able to judge. I think the same, if I may say, is true about others. Jabotinsky, for example. I thought one of the most interesting thinkers, because he combined nationalism and liberalism. And I think just as Peres said he's never read Old Newland by Herzl until the 1990s, I think many leaders of the Likud party are very selective in what they have read by Jabotinsky, even though the big portrait of Jabotinsky hangs in their offices. If you look at his last book, it's a very interesting book. It's about the war and the Jews. And it's published in 1940, the year he died. And he has almost like a draft constitution of the future state in there. One of the sentences is, if there is a Jewish prime minister, there should be a vice prime minister who is an Arab. And he even says if there is an Arab prime minister, which he envisions too, there should be a Jewish vice prime minister. Now, again, would he say that today? We don't know. That was 1940. It was really just when the Holocaust started. He did not know what was going to happen. He did not know exactly what was going to happen with the Arab population. And of course, he envisioned a large state, which included today's Israel, plus, of course, West Bank and Jordan. So it's a different concept. But I think it is worth looking for politicians today a little bit when you recall their memory, when you have their portraits hanging. It doesn't hurt to know a little bit more of what they have actually said.
Yes, you know, and this goes directly back to this question of writing a history of an idea and its political embodiment. There's this temptation to look at Israeli politics through an ideological lens, and then to realize, as you just noted, that many of the ideological parties or their representatives do not really obey any of the ideological dictates that they supposedly adhere to. And then there's the other temptation to just see everything as real politics, as party politics, as interested manipulation of reality, and then to judge history along these lines. Do you think there's a way, a middle way between these two poles, or are we always to be tempted to either look at it ideologically or politically?
I think there's always a middle way, and I think politicians usually go for real politic, but they also evoke the authority of a Herzl, of a Jabotinsky, of a Ben-Gurion. And I think once you do that, it is worthwhile being informed. I'm not saying every politician should be a historian, although, you know, present prime minister's father was a historian. So he grew up at least in the spirit of the history. I think it is worth not using or misusing is the better term in that case, misusing history and the heroes you have. And it's only possible that both parties, let's say, have Herzl as a hero because they read him very differently. So there is always a middle way, and I am certainly not a politician, so I'm not giving, you know, I'm not giving advice to the to politicians. Only when it comes to history and the historical image, then I think we as historians have the right to say, well, I mean, maybe it wasn't exactly like that.
So as a historian, when you tell the story of contemporary Israel, the last part of your book deals with what you call global Israel. I think global is, it must be one of the most hyped words in contemporary discourse. But the title does sound apt. So can you maybe explain what is encapsulated in global Israel?
Right. So I tried to end the book on a little maybe unexpected note. And one of the interesting phenomena today is that there is something like a global Israeli community. And I see it in both ways. Those who might be future Israeli citizens and those who were past Israeli citizens. When Herzl wrote his, you know, foundational works on what would later become a Jewish state, he clearly envisioned that there would be Jews who would live in this Jewish state or state of the Jews, as he called it, and the others who would stay behind would totally, completely assimilate and cease to be Jews within a few generations. So there would all Jews would be, in a way, collected in the Jewish state. And now we have a certain almost ironical feature. Not only is there still a Jewish diaspora in addition to the Jewish state, and still at least by 2018, the majority of Jews do not live in the state of Israel, although it's close to half of them. There is an additional diaspora, which is an Israeli diaspora. Numbers are very hard to know, but it's safe to say that there are hundreds of thousands of Israelis or former Israelis who live in the United States and Europe. And most recently, Berlin seems to be the hotspot for young Israelis to come to live. So that is the one picture, and I'm interested in that, how Israeli culture spreads to different parts of the world, because many of the Israelis keep, in a way, their language and their culture and try to keep some of it, at least, for their children and even grandchildren, next generation, and of course some of them might return to Israel. The other side I look at is it's an interesting phenomenon that Israel has become a much more diverse society in many respects. Of course, we have Jewish immigrants from all over the world, but the recent diasporas, I'm not only talking about, of course, the Soviet immigration, but also the Ethiopian immigration, have brought more diversity than before. And there are other groups, and I look a little bit at them as well, who are either non-Jews or who are, well, let's put it in a way where we would say that their Judaism is at least not undisputed. And we have millions of people in the world who consider themselves descendants of the lost tribes of biblical Israel. Many people smile at that and think, you know, that's you know, it's an exotic chapter. But it's an interesting chapter because many of them are, in fact, waiting to immigrate to Israel. And I think that will be an issue we'll hear more about. Some did, but not that many by now. And that will be something which faces both the rabbinate in Israel, but also the immigration authorities. And they live in India and in Africa and other parts of the world, where, of course, Israel is also seen as a first world country. And I'm also, just to finish this, I'm also talking in this chapter about non-Jewish Russians and also some of the African refugees which have come to Israel in recent years.
So going back to the first part of this global Israel, the exporting or the growth of Israeliness outside of Israel sheds an interesting light on how Judaism is developed outside of the world. How do you see Israeli Judaism when exported to non-Israeli Jewish communities? How do you see it influencing the way Judaism itself is understood or practiced?
Yeah, it is very interesting because often, especially when you look at the smaller communities, not talking about New York or Los Angeles, Israelis are the only, let's put it in quotation mark, experts. The only ones who actually know Hebrew in this community, or some of the very few people who do know Hebrew, who are able, for example, and I see this in Europe, who are able to lead the prayer service, even if they're not religious, but they really can actually read from the Torah, or they can perform certain functions. And that is an interesting combination where secular Israelis become part of religious Jewish life, which they would have never joined in Israel because there is a clear divide between either Orthodox or secular, with very few Reform and conservative communities. But once they're in Europe or in America, they are more, many of them, not all of them, are more inclined to join a Jewish community, a congregation, maybe because of the education of their children or other reasons. And in a way, they then also give often something. They're able to give something to the community. You have now an Israeli-American organization which is basically dedicated to the preservation of Israeli culture in America. And you have circles in Berlin where a Hebrew library in a private home has been opened, where Hebrew schools are being planned. So you have kind of a preservation of Israeli culture in the diaspora, which in a way interacts with the more traditional Jewish life there.
Michael, we've taken too much of your time. Can you maybe tell us in closing what project or projects you are currently working on?
So I'm a historian of both Jewish history and Israeli history, and I'm actually going back for my next project to German Jewish history, and I'm writing a book on the circumstances of Hitler's rise to power, but I'm looking at his early phase as a politician. And I'm not looking at Hitler, as many others did, but the Jewish life and anti-Semitism around him in post-war Germany, and especially Munich, where he lived, which is also an interesting chapter because the first prime minister of Bavaria, when it became a republic in 1918, was a Jew. And many of the revolutionaries in this period were Jewish in Germany. And it was in this period, 1919, that Hitler's anti-Semitism also developed. So I'm looking at this very interesting chapter of both Jewish life and the rise of anti-Semitism in Germany after the First World War.
Sounds like a most interesting project. Professor Michael Brenner, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much.